From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
More borrowing on top of the spending behavior of the state government is not an optimal answer. And to go to market and tell bond buyers, hey, we don't have a balanced budget even now, and we haven't made any allocations or appropriations to pay down debt. We need a plan to repay the debt. Otherwise, we shouldn't be going out to borrowers and asking for more financing.
Unless there's some alternative, then I strongly encourage the governor to take advantage of the borrowing authority that he has and lower those old bills and start eating away at these outrageous interests, the interest charges that we have built up.
So unfortunately, because the governor vetoed Senate Bill 1, this became the very first time in our state's history that our office, the Office of Comptroller, was unable to make a general state aid payment.
Illinois Comptroller Susana Mendoza there describing apparently the first time in Illinois history that it has not made its main payments to schools on time at the beginning of a school year because the school's budget still has not yet been passed. There's spending authority, but there is no funding mechanism. We're going to be talking about that as well as controversy over whether the state should be borrowing money to help pay down its $14+ billion of overdue bills. We heard Governor Bruce Rauner and State Representative David Harris, one of the Republicans who joined Democrats to support the budget, going back and forth on that at the beginning of the show. We'll talk about all that and more this week on State Week. I'm Brian Mackey in the Illinois Capitol. Sean Crawford is away. Joining us from the studios of NPR Illinois in Springfield is Charlie Wheeler. He's director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. And on the line from Chicagoland is Natasha Kurecki, who covers Illinois for Politico and writes the daily Illinois Playbook newsletter. Thanks for joining us, Natasha.
Thanks for having me.
So let's begin by talking about the education funding veto. Just to kind of do a brief recap, the budget that Democrats and a little more than a dozen Republicans passed into law after 2 years without a budget requires a new funding formula. Mostly Democrats supported that and finally sent it to the governor, who promptly vetoed it, but didn't just veto it. He issued a big amendatory veto. Natasha, the Senate is coming back in on Sunday of this weekend. And I know depending on where you are in the State Week universe, you may hear this show different days this weekend. So we're talking about Sunday, August 13th. The Senate is going to come back. Do we know what the Senate will be voting on?
Well, they certainly have the votes to just do a straight override. I don't think that they'll have a problem doing that. And I think then the attention really turns to the House and what's the House going to do. Of course, they scheduled theirs for Governor's Day on Wednesday, which was no coincidence, I think. A nice message from Mike Madigan that, anything that the governor's trying to do will likely go down in flames.
Do you have any optimism that there could be any sort of negotiated compromise to this still? It seems like even there's been reporting this week that even Republicans were surprised by the breadth and extent and depth of changes in the governor's amendatory veto of the education funding changes.
Well, for one thing, I think the next there have been negotiations going on, but I think their next meeting is scheduled for Monday, and the Senate's supposed to take its vote on Sunday. So that's one thing. But the other is, yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, lots of lawmakers said that they were surprised. They thought, okay, Chicago, he's been talking about, pulling Chicago out of the bill. That part we can get behind, but all of this other stuff, it's much more complicated. It's affecting suburban school districts and other school districts across the state. They didn't know about it. They were taken by surprise. So how do they get behind that? So I think that tends to benefit, Democrats of getting more Republicans over to their side to possibly, get an override of some kind. If they don't have the numbers now, they can try later. They could try to do a trailer bill maybe and fix some of the issues. And maybe that's where some negotiations will go into it. But I just don't see where Rauner has any leverage right now. You have all kinds of people coming out against what he did. He doesn't have numbers. As we know from the Illinois State Board of Education, there was a big error there. So he doesn't have any numbers to back up what he's saying. And then he was very secretive with how he was going to do this amendatory veto, and it turned out very differently than what he said he was going to do. So he doesn't have a lot of ammunition going in there. And I think there's also just this general sense of smelling weakness from the governor. And at one time, he was able to keep Republicans in line, with the threat of primaries and he had more all this money. I think that's just falling away day by day.
It seems to me that the problem was when he talked about what he was going to do ahead of time, and he toured the state talking about a Chicago bailout and I'm going to stick it to Chicago. And I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but you hardworking taxpayers in downstate Illinois shouldn't have to bail out Chicago. And all of this divisive rhetoric, which I think is very unbecoming of any governor of the state of Illinois, but apparently this is Rauner's stock in trade. And then he finally rolls out this thing that hurts most of the school districts in the state of Illinois, and then he mischaracterizes it. The thing that's going to cause the most damage is a change in how school districts' tax base is calculated. Right now, in the Collar counties, in Cook County, and in roughly a third of the downstate counties, there are tax caps. A local government, including school districts, can't ask for more money from property taxes next year than they did this year in excess of the rate of inflation. And the existing school aid formula takes that into account and says, well, in terms of measuring your tax base, we're not going to count this stuff that you can't access because of tax caps or because, basically it's the tax caps is the problem. And Rauner is taking away that. He's also taking away an exemption for TIF districts. And so that when you look at what is the tax base for a school district, under Rauner's plan, it would include all of your assessed valuation, even that which is in TIF districts, which you can't really get any money from, or all of that that is in excess of your tax cap, which, again, you can't use. So it artificially will make districts look wealthier than they are. And because the formula, the new formula, intends to drive money to poorer districts, the result is that a lot of districts are going to wind up losing under Rauner's plan as opposed to the original legislation that cleared both houses last spring.
So if this was a surprise to you, Charlie, based on what the governor's rhetoric was going around the state, and it was a surprise to Republicans, as we've seen reported, do we have any idea where these changes came from?
I don't know. I wasn't, I'm just getting back from being up in Wisconsin where there are a lot of other issues going on, but school aid funding wasn't one of them that I was paying attention to when I was on vacation. So I'm not sure what the genesis of it would be, although it's been noted elsewhere that the governor has changed his inner core, his inner office staff, and replaced a lot of people who had practical legislative experience, a lot of them with Congress, some with the state. And a lot of those folks are gone, and they've been replaced by people from the Illinois Policy Institute, which is a think tank that is very much in the free market mode, very conservative, and for years has complained about this, about basically TIF districts and about allowing school districts and other local governments not to take into account the tax caps. So it could be that some of his new advisors are saying, this is not a good idea. TIF districts picks winners and losers. The tax caps allow school districts to get more money than they should, and it just so happens that the school district that's getting the biggest chunk of the pie is Chicago, So that plays into what seems to be Rauner's obsession basically with damaging the Chicago Teachers Union with whatever it takes.
Natasha, do we know, are there any school, I mean, we're, you know, people who are listening who have school-aged children are probably wondering, is my school going to be able to open? Is it going to be able to function? Do we know if there are schools that are on the brink of, you know, insolvency because of the state's delay here?
Well, there certainly are schools that say they can probably open, but not for long. So Waukegan School District, which is a very large school district up north, said it can stay open for maybe 45 days. The Elgin superintendent of schools, which is that district is the second largest in the state, has said that he is facing all kinds of peril. There's a lot of concern in central and southern Illinois, a lot of them in Republican districts. So, as I said earlier, there's just not a lot of leverage for Rauner right now, in getting his way here. I mean, where is the benefit? Who is this benefiting? So I think there's a lot of concern in general from different school districts, and it's, as usual, hitting some of the poorest, low-income areas. Elgin and Waukegan have a very large minority communities, and it's hitting them the hardest. And I was, Chicago Public Schools and Rahm Emanuel reiterated this week, and that is that, he says no matter what, the school is going to open, schools will open on time. Of course, Chicago has had to borrow to pay off borrowing, so they're, not exactly in the greatest financial situation to do this, but they are going to plow through and do it.
Yeah, and that's sort of another pernicious effect of this, is that the poor districts, which rely more heavily on state aid, are going to be suffering. The wealthy districts that have huge tax bases, where the equalized assessed valuation is in the millions of dollars per student, aren't going to have to worry because they only get maybe a nickel of every dollar of their school expenses from the state in the first place.
Charlie, can we talk about, Natasha mentioned earlier that the numbers, the analysis, commonly when you do a big school funding change, you run it through the State Board of Education. They have complicated computer software that runs, how this will affect every district. They break it down by lawmaker, right? So lawmakers want to know how this is going to vote. And it's pretty unusual. The governor did not have this ready to go. And as Natasha pointed out, there was a mistake apparently from between the Department of Revenue and the State Board of Education caught this. And so they're rerunning the numbers. It doesn't look like they're going to have them by the time the Senate comes back on Sunday, at least not as we go to air midday Friday. This is pretty unusual, right?
Yeah, but everything about this administration is pretty unusual based on, what I've seen watching this stuff for darn near half a century. The governor says, for example, well, I couldn't ask them to score my plan until I actually had the bill. And I'm thinking to myself, no, that's not true. You're the governor. You appoint the head of the you appoint the State Board of Education, which controls the bureaucracy over there. Why couldn't you say, here's what I'm thinking of doing. Would you run it for me? They'd do that. They don't have to wait until there's actually something in the legislature. And so he could have done that. And he blamed the Democrats. Well, why did you take so long to send me the bill? Why were you stalling? It's all Mike Madigan. And I'm thinking, well, on the one hand, if there's negotiations going on and they held the bill with a parliamentary maneuver, what that means is if the negotiations bear fruit, they can bring that bill back, make an amendment on it, and do it in a matter of a couple hours. Whereas once they send you the bill and you've done an amendatory veto on it and they don't like your veto, they either have to override you, which is going to take more time, or they have to start afresh with a different bill, which is also going to take more time. And I suppose the likelihood, as Natasha said, is that they will override in the Senate. That's probably not much doubt. And then the question is, are these negotiations bearing fruit to the point that before the two-week deadline for the House to act is up. They can bring forth new legislation that's agreed upon and that will pass with the required three-fifths majorities and be signed by the governor. Or in the alternative, when it gets to the House, will there be enough Republicans, particularly from downstate and suburban districts, who are going to be who are going to see their school districts hurt by the governor's action, are going to be willing to break ranks and vote their district instead of Bruce Rauner and his millions?
Well, we will be watching and keeping you up to date with what happens in the school funding debate in the session. Stay tuned to your local public radio stations for more on that in the coming week. This is State Week. Our panelists, Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois Springfield and Natasha Korecki of Politico. I'm Brian Mackey. Natasha, there was some debate this week back and forth between Illinois Comptroller Susana Mendoza and Governor Bruce Rauner over part of the budget that deals with paying down the backlog of bills and borrowing to do that.
Right. So, Mendoza has really kind of went on the offensive. She has before, but then she did again just this week, sounding the alarm and saying, like, you know, the budget has gone through. This gives you authority to offer up to $6 billion in bonds. It'll immediately enable the state to lower the interest rate it pays on its debt. She's saying that it costs $2 million a day in late interest penalties. So she was really pushing this hard. She sounded the alarm again. She put out a new video on Monday. And the governor, just kind of put it aside. He said, yes. He did say that, there are some things that we should and we will refinance. He did mention that at one of the press conferences. But then he kind of went back and as you played the clip earlier, just said that, no, this is more of the same kind of practices that we don't want, and we shouldn't be going to the bond market and giving these conflicting strategies when we don't have a full strategy. So it's just, yes, and as I think you mentioned, people are just scratching their heads over that because it is a way to save money right away. No one wants to keep borrowing, of course, but no one also wants to just throw $2 million a day out the window. So this is a way to get that $15 billion backlog down, and so far he's seemed reluctant to do it in a large scale way.
And to me, that makes absolutely no sense. Think of it. Imagine yourself being a homeowner and you have a mortgage, and your mortgage is at 8%, and you could refinance it maybe at 3.25%, 3.5%. Why would you not take that option? And the difficulty is that the governor talks about borrowing as though we're not already borrowing. That $14 billion plus in the bill backlog is effectively money that we've borrowed from our providers, and they're suffering because of it. And so we have to pay roughly 12% interest on the vast majority of those $14 billion. So to me, we could go to the market, and we certainly would not have to pay 12% on our bonds. We could probably get them for maybe a third of that. The only advantage is if you do sell bonds, you're obligated to repay them according to a timely schedule. If you borrow from providers, you don't ever have to pay them. And so if you want to be, somebody who is a deadbeat, then yeah, you're not going to sell bonds to help retire your debt.
Charlie, isn't there, just to be a bit of a devil's advocate here, an argument, though, that bonding should be used for, right? The reason you get a bond to pay for something over 30 years is that because it's going to be something you're going to use in that time, maybe at a highway or a bridge or a school building or something like that. And in this case, we're talking about having future generations pay for bills that we already paid or should have been paying 2 years ago, and expenses, just operating expenses. Would the more fiscally responsible thing to do be to raise revenue to pay those things off as we go, right?
Well, one could make that argument, but then I would point out and counter that in the past, the state regularly would refinance existing debt when they could get a lower interest rate. And so they would, you know, I don't have it fresh in my memory the exact numbers, but they would be able to go out and sell bonds to do refinancing. And that's gone on for years. I don't think any's occurred under Governor Rauner. There may have been some. And so in my mind, this is just refinancing an existing debt.
One thing I'd just add is it's just another reminder of how the dynamics have changed so much since Mendoza has come into office and there's a Democrat and not a Republican there. I think, you know, she's putting these videos out. She's really getting out there and making, you know, these different decisions well known. And, you know, you just got to wonder if Munger was there, how this all would happen. Would she even bring it up? You know, maybe she would, maybe she wouldn't. But certainly Mendoza's gone on the offensive on a lot of these issues. And it's an interesting political dynamic to watch.
Yeah, and I would say, looking at it historically, Mendoza is more in the tradition of what comptrollers have been over the years. I remember when Dan Hines was comptroller, he had no problem criticizing Rod Blagojevich, a fellow Democrat, for what he was doing. And it's sort of been routine that from day one, the comptroller's office has been independent in terms of its financial judgments. Now, sometimes they've not been real harsh critics of a governor of their own party, but they've always been out there arguing for fiscal responsibility. And part of the reason is the comptroller writes the checks. And so when people don't get timely payments, the comptroller is the one who gets the heat. The comptroller is the one who has to do the triage and decide who are we going to pay and who are we going to stiff on any given day.
We've got about 5 minutes left in the show. I want to turn to politics now. As we tape Midday Friday, the Cook County Democratic Party is heard from gubernatorial candidates and other candidates previously, and they are deliberating on their slating decisions. So we do not know the outcome of that as we tape. But we did have some other political news this week, Natasha. J.B. Pritzker has chosen a running mate. I think he's the first sort of Tier 1 gubernatorial candidate on the Democratic side to announce running mate. Can you tell us a little bit about Juliana Stratton?
Sure. She was best known when she ran against Ken Duncan and was able to unseat him with the help of millions of dollars and President Barack Obama, who cut a campaign ad for her. But she's, you know, she seems very well liked. She's a freshman, so she doesn't have, you know, a ton of baggage politically for people to pick apart. So that could be one saving grace. But the main two things that you know people are pointing out is that she gets two key voting blocks, kind of energized potentially women and black voters, and you know, and as many people have mentioned this week, you know, Governor Pat Quinn was criticized again and again for not choosing an African American or a minority as his running mate, I think that turned off you know, a certain segment of the voters. And with J.B. Pritzker, I think it can only help him to have a female and you know, someone who is an African American and has some, you know, legit roots in the community. You know, she's worked as an arbitrator. She's worked with Tony Preckwinkle, and you know, she's a state rep. So she has a lot of things going for her. Of course, you know, Republicans will jump on that and say, you know, she tying her immediately to Mike Madigan because, you know, she was the person who was hand selected to run against Duncan, who fell out of favor with Democrats. So, yeah, it's an interesting choice and probably, you know, a very smart one for Pritzker.
Natasha, you had a story, I think it was Friday morning, about looking at some of other J.B. Pritzker's businesses and the role of women there. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. In the playbook on Friday, we reported just about some of his private companies and the lack of women that he's had there. So he has a private capital group, and you know, there's nine individuals with titles managing partner, investment partner, or venture partner, and they are all male. The investment team has 22 people, and just one was female. And then for his venture capital group, it was kind of the same story. There was eight individuals with, you know, high-ranking titles like founder, managing partner, venture partner, and all male again. So, you know, we asked Pritzker about this, like, you know, what's going on? There are more women there. And they sort of pointed to just an industry-wide issue just with getting women into venture capital in key positions. They also pointed to that they've been, you know, recognized nationally for investing in women-run businesses. But it is, you know, it's one of those kinds of things, and I think I recall Rauner getting hit on this as well for a lack of minority hires in GTCR, which was his, you know, investment private equity group. And, you know, it was the same explanation. Oh, it's hard to get, you know, recruit these kind of people. So we just thought it was something to kind of shine a light on. And certainly he has hired, you know, with Julianne Stratton, I think that helped him there. And then he's in his campaign, his campaign manager is female. A lot of his communications people are female. So it does seem like he's hiring some on that side.
And he would probably point out that he was a big Hillary Clinton supporter over the years.
Right,
over,
absolutely.
Hometown favorite, Barack Obama. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, right. Which cuts both ways for him.
Yes, absolutely. There's a video of what CNBC or something where it keeps coming back. But we'll have to talk about that another week. It's time now for Notes from the Field. Natasha Kurecki of Politico.
I'm going to just stick with this the soda pop tax with Cook County that was incredibly unpopular. There's been story after story all week, but one of my favorites was you know, a woman in who lives near the Indiana border drove to Indiana Walmart to make a purchase there so she could have lower taxes. And somehow there was a mistake, and there was the Cook County soda tax was assessed on her Indiana Walmart purchase by accident. It was some computer error, but it, to me, just made me chuckle.
The long arm of the Illinois tax law. Charlie Wheeler.
Well, Governor Rauner signed one of the items, that legislation enacting one of the items on his turnaround agenda, and it, given all the other turmoil and conflict, the stuff gets overlooked, and the subject is pretty much dry as dust. It had to do with changes in the procurement code, the rules and regulations that the state government and agencies have to follow when they're buying goods and services. And in the wake of Rod Blagojevich, changes were enacted really tightening up the process with all kinds of red tape, 72 hurdles you had to jump through to buy a pencil, that kind of stuff. And it was really hurting the efficiency, particularly of universities. And so legislation was adopted in the legislature by wide majorities in both chambers, and the governor signed it to cut some of this red tape and get on a more reasonable way of buying our goods and services.
That is our time for this edition of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois Springfield and Natasha Kurecki, who covers Illinois for Politico and writes the Daily Illinois Playbook newsletter. You can get a podcast of this show at nprillinois.org or on the NPR One app. Production assistance for today's program was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Brian Mackey.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.